ॐ सहना भवतु सहना भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति 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 ब्रह्मण्यारोपितत्वेन प्रमावस्ते इमे इति प्रमावस्ते इमे इति निशङ्कनीयं सर्वासां निशङ्कनीयं सर्वासां ब्रह्मण्येवाधिरोपणात् ब्रह्मण्येवाधिरोपणात् सन्धि Brahmani, arupitatvena, Brahma, avaste, ime, iti, na shankaniyam, sarvasam, Brahmani, eva, adhiropanat. Brahmani, arupitatvena. Because of being arupita, just read the verse first, and then I'm going to kind of take you back to remind you of a few things here. But Brahmani, on Brahman, arupita tvena, because of being superimposed, arupa, superimposed, right, adhyasa. So arupita tvena, because of being superimposed, Brahmani, locative, on Brahman, Brahma avaste, ime. These two avastas, these two states of experience, this word I want to work a little on, this word avasta, it's an important word. These two avastas, these two states of experience belong to Brahman. Iti, na shankaniyam, don't think this. Let's not have this doubt. Let this doubt not be there. That because of everything being superimposed upon Brahman, Brahman is basically... These two states of experience belong to Brahman. So Brahman is having these experiences. So we have to remind you now what all of these different avastas are, these states of experience. Why? Sarvasam Brahmani eva adhiropanat. Because of the superimposition on Brahman of everything. Absolutely everything is superimposed upon Brahman. So you can't single out these two states. Okay, so I want to remind you now what we mean by the states, what Vidyaranya is talking about here, because we've been working on this for a while. Right? We're two classes into this. This is quite a long section. Two classes into this particular section. Vidyaranya, the author of this book, is defining the experiences of the jiva. From the beginninglessness of the jiva that begins with ajnanam, up through moksha. He's saying there are seven phases or seven states of experience. He uses this word avasta, seven avastas. The avasta, the word avasta is a technical term that's usually used in this way, avasta trayasakshi. So most of us know this term, avasta trayasakshi. The one who is the witness of the traya, of the three states of experience, waking, dream, and deep sleep. Right? The atma is the sakshi. And there's a whole prakriya, there's a whole teaching methodology around differentiating the innermost self, the atma, right, from the waking, the dream, and the deep sleep. So now these waking, dream, deep sleep are looked at as the three states of experience that we go through. Right, you can divide your whole life up into the waking state, the dream state, and the deep sleep state. The waking state, when they look at the waking state, it's whatever I'm awake and experiencing through my sense organs. That's what we mean by the waking state. The dream state is any time that I'm not engaging the sense organs. That could be in dream, imagination, daydream, you know. Deep sleep is when I'm not engaging the mind in any type of activity, or I'm not having sense data either. Right? So the mind itself is resolved. That could be deep sleep, but also it could be something like coma or any of these kinds of states. So you can take these three, waking, dream, and deep sleep, as the overarching experiences that we can into which we can categorize everything else. So when we use avastas like this, we're using it as states of experience. So now that's kind of the feel of this word avasta. So now if we say, what are the states of the jiva, the avastas of the jiva? He has seven of them. The first three, he says, are responsible. This is Vidyaranya now, how he's using this as a prakriya, as a teaching methodology to help you understand the nature of yourself and what belongs to the jiva, what belongs to the atma. So he's using this as a prakriya. Prakriya means teaching methodology. It's all right. The first three are, first of all, ajnanam, which is beginningless, ignorance. Right? And the example he uses for ignorance is just the complete indifference, say in terms of self-ignorance. It's just absolute complete indifference as to whether there is a self or not. It's not even thought about because the answer is already here. Here I am. Why would I ask if there's a self or not? Yeah, because here I am. And so there's no question. It's just the natural born result of that ignorance that is naturally there, that nothing has to be, doesn't have to be thought about. So that's the ajnanam. That's the first. He says this ajnanam has two aspects. One is avritti, also called avaranam. Avritti and avaranam come from the same root. The avritti, right, means the covering, that which covers the thing that I would otherwise know. So he uses avritti, he separates avritti from ajnanam by giving an example like this. He says, it's like philosophizing, he has this idea, say you're philosophizing on the nature of the self. And you say, well, obviously, if somebody were to ask you, is there any self which is limitless and changeless? You would say, well, what do you mean? I don't see any self like that. How could such a self exist? How could there be such a self? I don't see any self like that. I've never heard of a self like that. I don't see a self like that. I don't experience a self like that. I know nothing of such a self. That's avritti, because you are that self. Right? So, obviously, something's wrong here. There's something that's being covered. So the ajnanam, the ignorance, causes this covering. And then the third is the vikshepa. When the nature of your being is here but covered, then it lends itself to adyasa, to superimposition or to projection. Because here you are, and here is that ajnanam covering the avritti. But since you're here, now the mind has to do something with you. You're here, but you don't know who you are, right? So you say, I am an existent conscious being, and what kind of existent conscious being am I? Well, I must be this body and mind and sense organs and this whole complex here. I must be that. That's what I experience myself to be. That's the vikshepa. Because since you don't, you experience yourself, but you don't know yourself. You experience yourself because you are yourself, right? But the avritti, the covering is there. And so upon that, because the covering is there, there's a projection. That's what we call vikshepa. So this ajnanam, ignorance, avarna, that covering, or concealing, and the vikshepa, the projection, these three bring about the samsara, the sukha, the bondage. Because it means that you've identified yourself with that which changes, and that which is subject to death, right? So you're bound by the given upadi that you've now taken yourself to be. Those are three. Then the other four are to lead to liberation. Paroksha jnanam, which is indirect knowledge, that gets rid of the avritti, the covering that says there is no self. That the paroksha jnanam is, say somebody comes and tells you, you know, there is such a thing as an ancient teaching in the Upanishads, which actually reveal the nature of the self as being limitless, and that in fact your being is the being of the whole creation, right? Your being is the being of the whole creation. That's the paroksha jnanam. So you say, oh, really? There is such a being, really? But my being is limitless. Oh, is that right? I'm so happy to hear that. That's indirect knowledge. But now, the idea of a limitless self, limitless being that is the truth of the creation, is no longer unknown to you. You know it indirectly. So you could say, oh, such a thing as Brahman, as the limitless self, is. That's astitvam. So the paroksha jnanam removes the ignorance of the existence of such a reality, even though you don't know it as I am that. The aparoksha jnanam, right, which is the fifth one, is not, oh, there is such a self, it's I am that self. That's the aparoksha. So he divides the paroksha, the jnanam, into paroksha and aparoksha. One takes care of, the paroksha takes care of the indirect knowledge takes care of the astitvam, that there is such a self. And the aparoksha takes care of the bhati, that I am that. The self is known to me. Okay, so now we've got five. Now if that aparoksha has taken place, then what happens is what we call shokamoksha. Liberation, or apagata also. Liberation from sorrow. Right? Because the nature of the self is free from sorrow. The world is full of sorrow. It's birth and death all of the time. You know, it's full of death, it's full of destruction, it's full of change. If it's full of change, that means any happy moment is going to be destroyed. Right? Mm-hmm. The sad moments will be destroyed too, but the sad thing is that, okay, let the sad moments be destroyed. We'll go along with that part. All sad moments will be destroyed. But then you have to also say, yeah, and all happy moments will be destroyed also. And so say you know as a jiva, as an individual, oh my gosh, all my happy moments will be destroyed. All that I love will be destroyed. All that I'm attached to will be destroyed. This experience, every experience I have is momentary. So this is reality. This is the reality of samsara. This is the reality of the creation. This is why we need a defense system, right? to help us cope, to live happily in such a reality, right? Where everything you love is subject to death. Period. Okay, so how can one have moksha as long as there is any type of dependence on such a reality? It's not possible, right? It's not possible to have shoka moksha, freedoms from sorrow, if I am dependent upon that reality, because there is nothing here that is lasting, right? So I can't, there's nothing to hang on to. And so sure, when one knows oneself, which is stable, which is not subject to change, whose very swarupa, whose very nature is whole and complete, and in fact everything that you seek, when that is recognized as constant and stable in the very being, which is the truth of the creation, when that is recognized and seen, you are liberated from sorrow because the nature of that self, which is you, is free from sorrow. That's why you're liberated from sorrow. The creation is full of change, 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 birth and death. But yourself is free of that. And if the self is what you seek, really, then the mind is never apart from that which is free of change, free of death, whose nature is whole and complete. So it's over in terms of sorrow, right? Unless you say, I am what I'm looking at. If we're looking at, if you say, I am what I'm experiencing, I am, like if my mind is feeling badly, and I have an identification with my mind, then I am feeling badly, right? But what if the ahankara, what if the I notion is not identified with the mind or the condition or with any seemly, whether subtle or gross, if that is not my point of identification, but my point of identification is with my being, then I cannot say that I'm sorrowful, because that's not the reality of my nature. My nature is not sorrowful, and it never has been sorrowful. So what if the ahankara, the I notion, is abiding there? Then I am fine, and then sometimes this is happening, and sometimes this is happening. That's the reality. Okay? So there's ashoka moksha, and then the seventh avastha is what we call nirankusha triptihi. Unfettered, nirankusha means unheld, unfettered, tripti, completeness, satisfaction. Tripti is satisfaction. All is well with me. And it is unfettered because the self is unfettered. The self isn't satisfied just for the moment or whole just for the moment. That is its very nature. So the nature of that self is unfettered fullness. When the mind has differentiated and recognized me, my nature, and my nature is unfettered satisfaction, what do we mean by that? It means that the very nature of yourself is whole and complete and all is well. I don't want any more. I can't even imagine wanting any more. I am, what I am is, you know, what do they say in the Bible? They say, I am that I am. I love that. It's, you can't be, there's no more than that. If you imagine Yahweh saying, you know, I am that I am. And to me, that's an absolute complete statement. So it's the end of it. You know, the one who is the one who is. And that one you are. That's the tripti. So when the mind recognizes that, there's a unfettered fullness and satisfaction because you can never change that fact. You can never change that nature. You can't. It won't become less on you. So it's whole and complete as is. So that's the seventh avastha. Right? So that shoka moksha, freedom from sorrow, and unfettered satisfaction is what we call just the that's nature of the self, and that's the nature of the mind that enjoys the self. See? So that's called moksha. The paroksha jnanam, then followed by the aparoksha, the paroksha jnanam followed by the aparoksha, indirect and direct knowledge, that is the means for liberating you from the ajnanam, ignorance, which causes the covering and the projection. So what's going to free you from ignorance? Not anything that you do. I mean, what frees you from ignorance is knowledge. So the whole thing, the whole understanding here really is that you are already full. You already are limitless. So there's nothing to do. There's nothing you can do because it's already an accomplished fact. So that means there's something that has to be recognized. And it's, you are already whole. So there's nothing to do and nowhere to go. See? Because we're talking about you. So the self is already whole and complete. The mind doesn't recognize that because of beginningless ajnanam, beginningless ignorance. Right? And so now that knowledge has to take place. So these are the avastas. So now the doubt came. Okay? Now the doubt came. Vidyaranya creates a doubt for you, right? And he says, "All right, doesn't let's look at it this way." Says, "You say, you know, that the vikshepa comes after the ajnanam, the projection, right? The projection comes after the ignorance, not before it. And so you have like this, you have the self, you have Brahman, and then you have this ignorance that causes this covering, then that projects the samsaritvam, right? And so we can say the samsaritvam, then the samsari will go through this sorrow and all of these problems and then become liberated and all of that. But you know what? The ignorance and the avarna, these two have to belong to Brahman. Because? So those avastas, those states of experience, should belong to Brahman, to the self. Not to the vikshepa, not to the samsari. Because the samsari came out of that ignorance. The samsari exists because of the ignorance. Right? The one of you that says, oh, I'm a limited, sorrowful person bound by death and all of these notions, this false identification. You have this false identification exists, this jiva exists because of the ignorance. See, because in reality, really, there is no jiva. There's only yourself, which is Atma, which is limitless. So whenever your mind, whenever you say, even whether you have ignorance or knowledge, the fact is, whenever you say, I am, I exist, I am a conscious being, you are referring to Brahman, nothing else. You are Brahman. That is your experience. It's not like you become Brahman or you do something to morph into Brahman. You are Brahman. Right? But the jiva, this person, the jiva is what? The jiva really is Brahman. Right? There is really no jiva. But because of ajnanam, the mind says, creates this false individuality saying, oh, you know, I'm a limited suffering being. That false individuality can only be created out of ignorance and was not here before. So this is what we were talking about last week. Right? That jiva wasn't here. Ignorance comes first. And so now the problem is Brahman must be suffering from ignorance. The avastha, the ajnanam, must belong to Brahman. So poor Brahman is ignorant. It's the problem. So Vidyaranya says, no, it's not like that. Brahman isn't ignorant. Yeah, we're still on last week now. Brahman, it's not that Brahman is ignorant. Even though the ajnanam, the ignorance, precedes the vikshepa, the limited jiva, the ignorance precedes it, still it is the avastha of the jiva. It is the experience of the jiva because the jiva is the one who identifies with that ignorance. Okay? Not Brahman. And now he's going to go on with more of this. So last week I gave the example and these verses now are going to fit in nicely with this example. So I tried to explain this to you in this way. So how this is a little bit more of how Vidyaranya talked about it. Ajnanam, ignorance, is beginningless. It doesn't have a prior condition. What would the prior condition be? It would be knowledge. Ignorance doesn't come out of knowledge. Knowledge destroys ignorance. Right? But that's why ignorance is considered actually as something positive because it has this avarana vikshepa, this power to cover and to project. But it itself is beginningless. Right? And we look at ignorance, even in terms of Maya, in terms of the creation, as something which is beginningless but comes to an end from the standpoint of the jiva. So now, if you look at it like this, this is what Vidyaranya is trying to get to here. If you think of this whole creation as a projection of Maya, you have Brahman the self, your being, plus the Maya, which manifests as the entire creation. Right? That's what we call Ishwara. Brahman with Maya is what we call God or Ishwara. It manifests as the entire creation. From the standpoint of Ishwara, the entire projection of the creation, there is vikshepa, not avarna. Right? Because limitless upadhi, limitless creation, limitless manifest knowledge. So there's none of this covering. But from the standpoint of everything within the manifestation, there's limitation because bound by time and space. Just like you see in this room, in one sense, from the standpoint of Ishwara, this room is one vision. It's part of one whole. Right? It's like, say, if I think of myself just as Ishwara, and this room is all that there is, this entire room is one manifestation of knowledge that has many parts. So, like if I use the example of a dream, say this room is my dream creation or my imagination, then the whole room is just one manifestation of knowledge that includes many, many parts. But from my standpoint, it's just one. You see that? It's one projection. But now, what about every part within the projection? Every part within the projection of this room, including my body and your body, every single thing in this room, is nothing but that consciousness. Right? Its very being is the same me. The very one who projected the whole is the being, the truth of every single part of the room. So every single thing in the room enjoys the same me. There's nothing there. There's no substance there except for me. Like if you think in any imagination you have, in the imagination there is really nothing there except consciousness. Right? And the names and forms come as one manifestation with many, many parts. Everybody see that? Like if I ask you to imagine this room, the whole manifestation is you. It's only your consciousness with all of these names and forms that we call Maya. So from my standpoint as the Ishwara of the room, that's fine. I have no problem. Right? Because I'm not attached to any given thing. It's just this manifestation comes from me, is sustained by me, and resolves into me. There's no problem. There's no limitation at all. There's no ajnanam, because I am the whole. But from every single part in the room, there is limitation. Say every creature, every conscious being in the room that has a body, mind, sense organs that allows for the consciousness, that very phenomena creates. I mean, it's a product of ignorance because you're not the whole. Your body is not the whole. Your mind is not the whole. Your sense organs are not the whole. And so what is Maya to Ishwara is Ajnanam to the individual. You see how that is? Because everything that makes you an individual is part and parcel of the Maya and is limited and subject to change. It enjoys fully every one of us, every body here, the rug, everything, the table, everything enjoys equally the one consciousness. The rug doesn't have, the table doesn't have a subtle body. The lamp doesn't have a subtle body. But the human beings have a subtle body. Plants have a subtle body. Insects have a subtle body. Animals have a subtle body. They all reflect consciousness. You know, it's like if I hold up a mirror and a rock to the sun, they're both inert. Right? They're both material. But the mirror is like a subtle body. It reflects the sun. The rock doesn't. So here's the rock and here's the sun. You know? But all of them are nothing but consciousness. Because think, if you have an imagination, the whole thing is equally your being. And it has no reality apart from you. So you are the truth of the whole. So in this room like that, your being, your conscious being that you are the truth of the whole. But from the standpoint of the jiva, even though the ajnanam came first, the jiva is the one who is identified, has an identification with the limitation. Right? The ahankara is identified with the limitation. And that is what makes the experience of ajnanam and avarana the avastha of the jiva, of the individual. Whereas for Ishwara, you know, or from the standpoint of the Atma, there is no limitation at all. There is no ignorance. There's just manifest knowledge. Right? And so you can't say that Brahman is here suffering ignorance. It's only what is, from the standpoint of one who is limited, that there is a suffering of ignorance. So what he says here is trying to, now we kind of move into this verse. He says, don't get confused here that Brahman is having these two avastas of avarna and vikshepa, of the ajnanam and avarna, because the vikshepa comes second. Don't get confused, you know, that Brahman is suffering from ignorance. Brahman isn't suffering from ignorance. You think that that Brahman is suffering from ignorance because these two states of experience are superimposed upon Brahman. No, that's not what it is. The whole universe is superimposed on Brahman. There is nothing here but Brahman. Right? So it's not that it's... Give me a shake.
Well, but I'm asleep. I'm just...
Snoring. You're half asleep because you're snoring.
Okay.
I don't mind you snoring.
He's only snoring. No,
snoring.
I'm not sleeping.
Snoring is good.
Sorry. That's cool.
Okay. When we say, when we use the... Now, there's some other words that are coming here that are really important words. One is aropa. Okay? Aropa is the word that when we use for superimposition. Okay, how many of you heard the word anyonya adhyasa? Means mutual adhyasa, mutual superimposition. Aropa is another word for the superimposition. So like, say for instance, we'll use for mutual superimposition, we use the example of a red hot iron ball where you bring fire and iron together. And they appear as one thing, where the fire becomes hot and heavy, hot, the fire becomes hot and round, and the iron ball becomes, you know, hot and red, right, red hot. And they look as though there's one thing that's a mutual superimposition. So now here, when we talk about aropa, we say that this whole universe, the whole manifest knowledge, is an aropa upon Brahman. So actually, there's a mutual superimposition, but not in the sense that Brahman is involved in this. But it's like this. Here you have an infinite display of knowledge. Infinite display of name and form. But this infinite three-dimensional display of name and form, all of it enjoys existence, astitvam. Means existence, it is. There's nothing here. No matter how much you dissect the world or look at it in terms of, look through a telescope, whenever you look at the whole, as much of the universe as you can, or you look microscopically into the universe, you never ever get away from its isness. The being that it enjoys is superimposed on it. Because none of this has being. All of it comes into being, goes out of being. Being never comes into being and goes out of being. Being remains. Existence remains. But things come into existence and go out of existence. That means everything in this universe, everything, on every level, subtle and physical, everything that you experience is bordered by non-existence. Because it comes into being and goes out of being. That means it's bordered on non-existence. On either side, it's called prakabhava and pradvamsabhava. Prakabhava means it wasn't there before it came into being. Pradvamsabhava means, and it's not there after. Everything's like that. Anything that comes in is born and dies. It wasn't there, and it's not there after. So how could it be in the middle? Really, if it's non-existent, how could it be in the middle? It can be in the middle because being itself is Brahman, is the truth. Being itself never varies. Being is what is. And so all this manifest knowledge, this entire creation, enjoys being invariably. But the being that it enjoys, can you say, okay, show it to me. Where is the being that this enjoys? Because you can't find it in the creation. Everything in the creation comes and goes and is infinitely divisible. You can't find any... Show me a little being, please, just a little. You can't find it. But you are it. You can't find it as an object, but you are it. And how do you know you are it? Or how do you label it when you say, I am? What are you referring to? When you say, I am, you're referring to your being. That's when you say, I am, it's not an object that you're looking at, but you're referring to existence itself. In fact, the only experience of existence is amnes. There is no other experience of existence. You try to find one. Like you'll say, initially you'll say, what do you mean? I am and it is. Right? I am, it is, you are. So you think, that's what you think. But can you see is? You can say the words, but can you have an experience of any isness outside of your own amness? And so when you say, I'm, what I'm saying, how Swamiji will joke with this, I say, why don't you just say like this? I'll give you two ways to say it. It is, it is, it is, it is, it is, it is, I is. Okay, that's good. Or you can say, I am, it am, it am, it am, it am, it am, it am. Because you can't find two types of isness. And isness itself, the being itself, is what we call aparoksha. Means it's not something that you can look at, but it's something which is. It is its own experience. That's why isness and consciousness are one and the same thing. And that's why, if you think in terms of this manifest knowledge, this room, you could say, okay, the one thing that's invariable in the room is isness. The other thing is consciousness. Because everything is known. Everything is known. In fact, you can't have an experience away from is known. That's the common denominator of all experience. It is known. The known part is your consciousness, which is the isness. That's the sat-chit. And so, upon this sat-chit, which is my being, everything is superimposed. I am the being, I am the sat-chit of the whole creation. And to really understand it so you don't have to make that jump to this creation. You can understand it just in terms, the truth of it in terms of any thought you have. That's why I say, okay, imagine this room. If you imagine this room mentally, you are the sat-chit, the conscious being of the room. You are the truth of it. You are the existence of it. Just in terms of your thought now. You are the very existence of it, but the existence is superimposed on the room. The room is superimposed upon the existence. But the only thing that's really there, the only substance that's there, really, is existence itself. So here he's saying, these two avastas of ajnanam and the avritti, yeah, they're superimposed on Brahman. You can say that as long as you realize that everything is superimposed on Brahman, including those two. There is nothing in the creation or to anything to do with the jiva that is not superimposed on Brahman. So I am the self of the whole thing. So if you say that, fine. So that's what his verse says. He says, these two avastas of ajnanam and avritti, these two things are the states of Brahman, if you say they belong to Brahman. Nothing belongs to Brahman. If you say the ajnanam belongs to Brahman because superimposed on it, no. Because everything is superimposed on Brahman. Nothing belongs to Brahman. Right? And a superimposition, even if you say superimposition, how does a superimposition belong to anything? Like take for example, if you use the rope snake example, right? The rope appears as a snake. Okay? Does the ignorance of the rope, this is what the people are thinking, this is what he's talking about. There's rope ignorance that allows for the projection of the snake. Right? Now think of the rope. Does the rope have rope ignorance? So would the rope have rope ignorance? Let's say, does the rope have snakeness? Does the rope experience I am a snake? Does the rope experience I am ignorant of being a rope? It doesn't experience anything. Right? It doesn't experience rope ignorance, and it doesn't experience the snake either. So now look in terms of yourself, of the Atma, of your being. Does your being say, "Oh, I'm ignorant. I'm suffering from ignorance." You can't talk. You can't talk. Because the vikshepa is not there, but here's the ignorance of really, you know, it's having this experience, avastha, it's having an experience of ignorance. It's having an experience of being covered. Is the Atma having an experience of ignorance, an experience of being covered, you know, which is causing all of these problems? We say no. The self doesn't have any such experience. The experience of the self is satchit. The experience of the self is just conscious being, right? From the standpoint of Ishwara, the experience of the self is conscious, from as Brahman, conscious being, plus the manifest knowledge of Maya. That's the experience of the self. Not the experience of the self, but the experience of Ishwara. If the Maya is there, the Maya is known, right? This is another thing. You think like this. If the Maya is there, this is actually worthy of some meditative time on your own. If the Maya is there, when we talk about Ishwara, right, so the manifest knowledge is there, is consciousness, the conscious being, knowing that? Or is the manifest knowledge known? From the standpoint of the manifest knowledge, it is known. Is consciousness knowing it? Or is it a manifestation of consciousness with Maya? It's a subtle difference, but it's very, very important. You know? Let me now think of it like this, just going inside into your own mind. You have an imagination. Say you imagine the room. Imagination. The imagination, now that the imagination is there, it is known. That's right? Say I ask you to imagine a meadow now. The meadow is there. You imagine it. It is now known. Whatever you imagine is known. Whatever you think is known. Whatever you feel is known. When it's there. Okay? Now say you withdraw the imagination. Has anything happened to your consciousness? Is it all of a sudden, it's not knowing now? The consciousness itself, your conscious being, is not performing the act of knowing. It just is pure, non-dual knowledge. With the Maya manifestation, now there's Namarupa, there's name and form. And that name and form is known. When the manifestation is resolved, then what is there? Exactly the same. Pure knowledge, pure consciousness, that's all. So there's no act of knowing that's taking place. Sometimes we use the example like this of the sun. It's a little bit remote, but it still works. If you think of the sun shining down on the earth, the sun is bright and luminous. And because of the sun, everything is seen, right? Everything shines. Everything is lit. Everything becomes manifest. It's seen. Is the sun lighting up the earth? You can say the very swarupa, the very nature, because the very nature of the sun lights up the earth. Is the sun performing an act to light up the earth? Not at all. The luminosity of the sun is the sun. The consciousness of the self is the self. It is not conscious of anything. It is just consciousness. But that consciousness with the Maya, right, means that whatever the Maya projects as is known, because consciousness is known. Right? Consciousness itself is self-evident. That's this very swarupa. So if you have a thought, because of the maya, that thought is self-evident. Consciousness is self-evident. The maya thought is self-evident. Why? Because it's not away from consciousness. See what I mean? But consciousness isn't peering at the thought. It's the thought itself is self-evident because consciousness is self-evident. That's why, in fact, you are not a knower. Your being isn't snooping around knowing this and knowing that. Your being is always self-evident. Right? It is always self-evident. Changelessly self-evident. And whatever takes place in maya, in the individual, in the mind, self-evident. Manifest knowledge for Ishvara, self-evident. But the self isn't going, oh, look at this. Look at this manifest. No, it's that the whole infinite creation of manifest knowledge is self-evident because the Atma is self-evident. That's why you are self-evident. No matter what is going on in your mind, whatever is going on, good, bad, blissful, it is self-evident. You are self-evident. And the self-evidentness that is your very swarupa, your very nature, never changes at all. That's the truth. But because of the aropa of the maya upadi, that self-evident truth of me, you know, has superimposed upon it, you know, your mind and your sense organs and your body from your standpoint, from Ishvara's standpoint, the whole infinite creation. But when the whole is superimposed, there's no limitation for there to be a jnanam, because infinite. But from a jiva within, where that same superimposition is there, it's just absolutely natural because there's nothing here but the self, right? But from the standpoint of the upadi, there's limitation, there's built-in ajnanam, and that ajnanam simply has to be removed by knowledge, by a teaching that points it out in you so you see it, points out the nature of this creation. So, and because the nature of reality is here, when it's pointed out, then you can see it. So, because, you know, because it's here to be seen. That's how this pramana works. And so what? Yeah. You have to stop. But now he's going to build on this. So this time I tried to make these seven avastas more clear, but now we're going to go through them again. So there's a few more verses. Let's stop here. This is enough. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om. Lynn?
So I kind of think that really caught between 5 and 6 would be a less experience. That's like the
Paroksha and Aparoksha?
No,
that's
true. I know I'm the self, but I'm not really free from sorrow. And it goes back and forth, like sometimes it's very clear, and sometimes I'm just really bad.
Yeah. There's a couple of things to understand there. First of all, so I'll do a couple of levels there. The self is totally present whether your mind is happy or sad. Even in a sad mind, the self isn't covered because it's the me. The me is present and you can objectify the sadness. Right? And in the happy mind also, the very same me is present. Can be differentiated from the happy state and differentiated from the sad state. So self-knowledge has to do with the recognition of that self, its freedom from these states of experience. Okay. So what tends to happen though is that nobody wants to have a sad mind, just like you don't want to have a hurt body or an ill body. The body would prefer to be very healthy. And the mind, sadness is almost like a sadness or anger or any of these type of things. They're almost like something in the mind that's like a virus or something that you want to expel it out of the mind. And the reason you want to expel it is because its nature is not true to you. Right? It's like a foreign invader, a foreign body has come in, and you do anything to get rid of it. Just like, like if some sort of a virus comes into the body, the whole body will attack it to try to shoo it out, right? Any kind of disease. And so sadness is kind of like a disease of the mind or something that we want to get rid of from the mind. So that is natural, to want to get rid of any type of sad thought. But now, as this knowledge starts to become clear to your mind gains a little strength. Then what happens is that the causes for the sadness in terms of your relationship with the world and your relationship with your own unconscious start to dissipate. And they start to, the causes themselves for the sadness, the experience of sadness, starts to dissipate because of the mind's recognition of where the true locus of happiness is. When you recognize where the locus of the experience of happiness is, really, that it's not in an object out here, but it's really the very nature of yourself, your mind becomes less and less dependent upon the world being in a particular way, or a person being in a particular way, so that I can be happy. So this dependence, this tie to the world becomes less and less and less, where I have to have it like this or I have to have it like that. That process relieves the mind of a lot of the burdens it's carrying that make it a samsari, where I demand things to be a certain way so I can be happy. So as you recognize the locus of happiness and you recognize the illusion, the grand illusion that the whole world is caught under, is basically, as long as I've lived and anybody else has lived for lifetimes, when I fulfill a desire, I become happy. Even though it's momentary, but still. When I fulfill a desire, I become happy. So what's the logic? I have to go on fulfilling desires so that I can be happy. But what about when I finally understand what is actually going on? And that is, the moment I fulfill a desire, for that moment, my mind is relaxed. It's not asking anything of the world at that moment. Right? Because it will, just give it a moment and it will ask. but for the moment, it is not asking the world to be different. And so it's enjoying Ashanti at that time. And in that type of state of mind, a bliss or happiness reflects in the mind. Okay. So because of that, and that's all we know about happiness is this bliss states that we can get, that we can generate in the mind by manipulating the world to suit me. So what about when you, there's two tiers to this, when you realize that the cause of the bliss state has nothing to do with the object, it only has to do with the relaxed mind. That's a huge realization. But then there's a deeper realization than that. And that is that the nature of yourself that illumines the sorrowful state or the bliss state, that the very swarupa, the very nature of my being, is a wholeness that is so complete and so solid. It's different than bliss and it's different than sorrow. It's something that is whole. It's an ananda which is only can be defined by your own being. It's not a bliss experience. And so that becomes, that is you. And when the mind is awake to that, it relaxes so deeply, because no matter what it's thinking, no matter what it's feeling, I'm there. And that I, that real I, it's different than a bliss, it's not dependent on a bliss state or a sorrowful state. That me is there no matter what. Always the same, no matter what the state. So now when that's understood, the mind relaxes even more. So now, as the mind matures in knowledge, you have to remember what your past is. Lifetimes and lifetimes is, I need this to be happy. That's the conditioning. And I need to not have this to be happy. They're both. It's got the same thing, though. I'm happy with these things and happy without these things. Right? So that's our conditioning. So that conditioning doesn't just change overnight. And then we have all the unconscious baggage of all the ways that we in childhood we were traumatized in this way or that way. Even no matter how good or bad, say you had even great parents, you're still traumatized. Because yeah, that's just how it is. And then, you know, our parents and the life that we have can often have some very traumatic elements. And so that stuff's all in the unconscious. And that's why it's also so important to kind of understand how to be with the external world, this world that through sense perception, but also how to be with the internal world that needs to sort through things in such a way that those traumas can heal. That's why the teaching that we have to, what we have to understand is how to be with the inside as well as with the outside, in such a way that these things can heal and that this knowledge that has so become so obvious to you takes root. You see?
Deeper and deeper root.
Deeper and deeper root. And actually the mind is, the self isn't becoming deeper and deeper, right? Yeah. But the mind is becoming more and more rooted, more and more clear. And a lot of the clarity has to do with yourself learning how to be with the mind, which is also part of Maya, right? Mm-hmm. So the mind isn't, the self is not hurt by the mind.
They make it sound so, what's sort of interesting to me, and I think it leads to confusion too for a lot of people, is they make it sound so black and white. And clearly, I don't know anyone's experience that is black and white.
You mean like overnight?
Overnight you're one
moment.
No sorrow. And I mean,
it's not like that.
Talking to everybody I've ever spoken to that I could, you know, in this tradition really knows, I don't think there's no one I've ever heard that's true for them.
No.
But it's sort of interesting that the teaching doesn't, I mean, you address this and Swamiji addresses this, but it seems so, so important, and yet...
But the teaching does address it. Oh, look at the Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah, I was thinking about the Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. It really does address it, but it's also up to the teacher to address all of that and make it clear so that you become so that you know how to handle the world and you know how to handle the mind, and you, you know, in light of this knowledge. You know?
It feels like it feels like that, like I'll go deeper, my roots will go deeper,
yeah,
and then something else will flow through, either internally or in the world, that will pull me in, and I'll get really hung up on it, even for a moment, but sometimes longer, you know?
Yeah.
Or a long moment. And then I have to, like, remember again, who am I, or something, but I get caught, and I get frustrated.
Well, maybe one way to look at it that can, instead of making you get frustrated, you can say, good, I'm making some progress.
Consolation.
No, but really, seriously. If your mind, okay, you say you get this knowledge, and then the mind has a little bit of relaxation from it when you're first exposed to it. As soon as it gets that little layer of relaxation, though, it deepens a little bit, and boom, all of this stuff comes up that has to be dealt with. Unconscious material will come up, right? That's how it works. Okay, so, okay, now we have to deal with all of this, and some of it's painful and hurtful, and it's like, oh, here's a big bunch of stuff that needs to be dealt with. You deal with it. Oh, good. Sinks a little lower. A little more shanti, a little more peace. All of a sudden, the next layer comes up. There it is. Now, this one is harder to deal with, but you're stronger. Okay, so it's not harder because you're stronger. Then that comes up, and then it keeps going like that, you know, until you kind of get to the bottom of the barrel. You know, you can kind of say, oh, gee, I'm getting close to the bottom of the barrel, you know, and then enough stuff has come up then that you feel much lighter inside. But there's a process of these things that are creating pressure and pain, right? And they release themselves and release themselves and release themselves over time. And all the way along, at the same time, because all the while along you're also learning, you're studying, you're gaining a clarity also, right? You also are learning how to be with your mind so that now, maybe now when this painful stuff comes up, you're more skilled at how to hold it so that it can heal. You know, and so you become more and more adept at being able to handle your own mind. And then, you know, that's also very useful because after a while, after some time, you do work through the things that cause so much pain. And having done that, that stuff is gone. And you also know how to be with your mind. And now you know how to be with your mind without big things to handle. You know?
So is the healing the resolution back into beingness?
There's no back into beingness. The beingness is already completely there. You're already completely there. But there's hurts and scars and wounds, you know, in the mind and in the unconscious. And those things have to work themselves out in time. Just like there are relationally with the people that are close to you in your life. We all have our own circle of people, a small circle and bigger, you know. And so just the day-to-day relationships with that you have, with the set of people in your life and the people that you work with and all of that, you know, they can be causing you pain. It's just how it is. But those people, on whatever level, and this is the whole Bhagavad Gita, let your life be sadhana. If somebody is causing you pain, you know, then it's that person is a sadhana for you. That relationship becomes a sadhana for you. Because why are they causing you pain? What's going on in terms of your knowledge and yourself is not causing you pain? They're not hurting yourself. They're not hurting your source of ananda. So that means that your orientation is causing you pain. Right? Your expectations are causing you pain. I mean, look in the universe, in our world. How many things are there that cause us pain? It's countless. You know, but then what orientation should you have? You know, that allows you to stay centered.
And that's where the prasada buddhi is? So.
Yeah, that's where the prasada buddhi, the karma yoga buddhi comes in, but also that of course is there. But I think also knowing how to be with yourself internally. Because
what do you mean by that?
I mean, what causes our pain are usually that causes real pain are really, I think, when unconscious complexes get triggered. Otherwise it's just kind of objective, you know, it can be a pain in the butt, but it's not the gripping pain. It can be a problem, but you can deal with it objectively because it's not triggering something in you. Okay, so now, say what is being triggered in you, there you have no internal means to handle it. Right? Because it's really not external. Right? I mean, if it were just external, then the person would be difficult and you have to deal with the person or whatever it is. That's not what bothers us. We do that all the time. It's just part of life. That's a lot different than when I have an inner reaction. So then you have to know how to be with yourself, to be with the child inside, to have kindness, to listen to ask inside, you know, what is it that's really upsetting me? All of this type of thing where there's an inner caretaking. That inner caretaking that most people don't even know about. What it means that we know about what it means to be kind to others, to be compassionate, to be kind. We all have that value. To be loving, to be kind, to be compassionate, to be thoughtful, to be patient, all of these things. We may not live up to it all the time, but we have the value. But most people don't put themselves as somebody who should be kind and loving and patient and caring and interested. Right? You don't include yourself in that. And so then the poor mind and the complexes inside become very deprived. Because, right? Very, very deprived. And who keeps the most company with you is you. And so you're keeping company with somebody who's just totally always depriving you. And be nice to everybody else. Mean to me, nice to everybody else. It's awful, really. And usually when it's pointed out, everybody goes, oh my God, that's true. It is true. You know? So that's life-changing, that recognition. And it allows then the hurts and pains of the psyche to have a chance to mature and grow.
You're right. It also seems, you know, that inner friend, that cultivating of that inner friend, or that reparenting with the good parent, it's also, it seems, the benignness of the self in a way.
It is.
Or it can lead up to it.
That's right.
Or it can be recognized with that particular.
That's exactly what it is. It is the benignness of the self. And so that, in fact, that whole reparenting and kindness, which is necessary when it's necessary, because sometimes when you're caught in a reaction, that coming in and just saying, having the one part of the wiser part of your mind say, "Oh, all right, you're so hurt. Tell me what it is." But there comes at other times when that voice, manifesting that voice, is not necessary because the kindness of yourself is there, caretaking the mind naturally. So you recognize that this kind voice has this Atma as itself. I think that's kind of what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And throughout this whole process, I mean, you're self-evident to yourself. I mean,
yeah, but the thing is, when there's a real complex there, mm-hmm. and a real hurt, and you're really gripped inside mm-hmm. with pain, to have the wiser part of yourself come in and listen and ask, just to ask what's really going on, and to allow yourself to just be with that, that is really, really healing. You know? Mm-hmm. And so you don't know any of that, how to manage the mind. How to imagine, you say you know nothing about it. How to manage the mind, how to manage the hurts, the complexes. And then they tend to just stay. Because you don't have the means for releasing them.
Right, it's also easy to see this as, you know, saying, you know, there's only the self, and you are that, and you're free, and so on. And to use that as almost like an affirmation, you know? You know, you've got stuff happening, going on, whatever that pain is. And you go, oh, I'm not the body, I'm not the mind. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, I see this all the time in spiritual circles.
I don't think it's... I mean, you wouldn't do that to a friend, right?
Wouldn't do what to a friend?
Well, you wouldn't go up to your friend who's really suffering and say... Oh, what the hell, you're not the body, you're not the mind, forget it.
I'll probably get slapped. Right.
It's better, I mean, even psychologically. Say, even in therapy as a therapist, you know, as a therapist, you need to have, your client needs to have the freedom to say the whole problem. Whatever the problem is, to be able to talk and be able to say exactly that problem, what that problem is. What if instead I just said, don't bother, I already know what it is. I'm telling you, it's not a problem. You know, forget it. It's really not a problem. You're fine. Go in peace. That's not how it works. You know, because you're dealing within Maya. Right? The Atma's fine. You're dealing with the mind and different parts of the mind, so.
Okay, what about if you like actually know that something's bothering you? I mean, it's really obvious, and you try to talk, you know, have that parent part come in, but then you can't access what's wrong. I mean, you know something's wrong, but you don't know what it. I mean, you just know it's maybe too deep. I mean, it's just hidden, or you can't say. Then what do you do?
You know, I think that, say if you know that how to be with that in a, whatever that hurt is, in a gentle way, and that part is not going to speak to you, because, so there's no way to really access what the problem is. As long as you can hold it with love, with non-rejection, then you just have to give it time. At least it knows you're there. And the psyche always knows you're there. Like say there's some pre-verbal part inside that's very hurt. I mean, there are such things as pre-verbal parts that aren't very hurt. They can't talk to you or anything. But you talk to it and you hold it with that type of attitude in its own time.
What do you mean pre-verbal?
Pre-verbal, before you can talk. Like, say a child is traumatized when it's 1 year old. I'm talking more psychologically now. Say a child is traumatized 6 months. Oh, 9 months old, 1 year old, 2 year old, can't talk. You know? And sometimes for adults, that pre-verbal trauma is there. And it can't, you ask it what's wrong, and it can't tell you. You know? Or it's just in the unconscious and you haven't reached that yet. You don't know when. It's not time. But by the mere fact that you are holding it, the one who's holding it is not traumatized. Because that separation has been the healthy part of the psyche, the strong part of the psyche is holding the weak part of the psyche. And so that means the weak part of the psyche is now objectified. Right? And then the strong part has the shanti. And if the strong part that has the shanti is is kind, then, you know, then the weak part is not being hurt. It's being loved. And that's what has to, that's how we have to treat ourselves.
But I wonder sometimes, you know, if there's such emphasis on dharmic life, you know, and being dharmic. I wonder if that's sometimes because, like, they knew, that Bhagavan knew that, because then if you project that the pain is so much, right, and it's like you said it a lot, somebody in pain lashes out,
yeah.
Right? So I think that's why one has to be dharmic, right? Not only because, like, it will create disharmony and confusion and anger in your life, right, and distortion, but it's also because that's the only way to clear that up.
That's
stop
right.
Projecting
the,
it.
The dharmic, yeah. The,
I'm not saying I'm doing that, but I'm noticing that.
Yeah. Dharma itself and shanti go together. You know, that's why in the world, dharma, it is so, so important, because with the dharmic life, shanti comes with the dharmic life. Right? And so that's why it's valued so highly. And that's experiential too. If you go against dharma, there's an upset that takes place internally. If you're with dharma, there's a strength and a peace.
Help me make sense of that. There is so much emphasis on be kind to other roots of Christianity, compassion with other, and how there was never really historically any attention to be kind to self. It's always love thy neighbor as thyself, but never attending to, like, the individual is the center, or
But even the Bible has been interpreted this way also, some beautiful quotes in the Bible. But what you just said, if you think about it, love thy neighbor as thyself. Right? As thyself. That means, what if you said it in the opposite way? Love thyself as you love your neighbor. If you love your neighbor as yourself, you're supposed to love yourself. But we haven't interpreted it that way, right? Just because we somehow, I think it's got mixed up with lack of humility or egoism and all of this. You're not supposed to love yourself or be kind to yourself. I don't know what it
not
is.
That's suffering. Suffering. Cross.
Mary Katie interpreted this what? As a statement of fact. So it says, love your neighbor, love yourself, hate yourself. Self hates your neighbor.
Yeah.
Of that. Yeah. You can't actually, if you hate yourself, you can't love your neighbor.
Yeah, it's very, yeah. And it all becomes kind of mixed up and phony, so.
Yeah.